Support for this episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere is made possible by the Wes Express, the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. Find them online at wessexpress.com and the Baker Street Journal, the leading publication of Sherlockian scholarship since 1946. Subscriptions available at bakerstreetjournal.com.
I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, episode 118. The future of Sherlockian scholarship.
I hear of Sherlock everywhere since you became astronomer.
In a world where it's always 1895, comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard Jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Baker Street irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burke Wolder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
Yeah! What a great time to be here.
Woohoo!
You got it, pal.
Yeah.
Welcome to
Energy, man. Energy. It's all about energy.
It is. Energized and energizing. I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast for Sherlock Holmes devotees where it's always 1895 means I am Scott Monty.
Thank goodness. And I am Bert Wolder.
And I don't know about you, Bert, but you know, we are closing in on Easter. I'm feeling like the Energizer Bunny this morning.
I'm feeling like a cracked egg. So I guess that makes a great loop on the holiday.
Oh, well.
Now, well, when Passover is coming, I'm feeling like some flat matzah, I suppose.
Oh, yeah.
toast like matzah.
Well, whether it's multiple cups of caffeinated coffee that get you up in the morning, or the thought of some manischewitz at the end of the day, whatever rouses you, we are delighted that you chose this time to hit that play button, to plug us into your ears, and to hear the rantings of a couple of crazy Sherlock Holmes freaks.
That's right. Nerds are us.
I'll take it. I'll take it. Well, we have had some great feedback to the last episode with Michael Sims, episode 117. If you haven't listened to that, get back to ihose.co/ihose117 and check out the interview with Michael Sims, the author of Arthur and Sherlock, the latest biography of Conan Doyle that really takes a much different approach to biography and the entire biographical process than you have likely read in the past. If you would like to give us some feedback about that show or anything you hear or see on ihearofsherlock.com, feel free to reach out and touch someone.
Wow.
Well, maybe just take it easy. Maybe you should just touch yourself. Wait a minute. No, I take that back. If you would like to reach us, you can do so by emailing us at comment@ihearofsherlock.com. You can leave a comment directly on any post that you see on the website, including this show. And the URL of this show, the notes for this show, are ihose.co/ihose118.
Yes, we would love your comments. Tell us if you think, you know, this color really suits us. What about the fit in the shoulders? Do you think that that's really properly tailored? And what about, you know, these socks and that tie? Come on, folks. We need some help.
Hey, easy there, Humpty Dumpty. You can reach us also by phone at...
Or how about I like what you've done with your hair? I mean, would it kill you for a comment? Come on, folks. Come on. Wouldn't kill you.
774-221-READ. That's 774-221-7323. That will reach our voicemail. where you can speak your dulcet tones into the gossamer wings of the internet, and we will play it on the air. As long as you don't use any profanities, folks.
No.
Try us. Yeah, who knows? Maybe we can bleep them out and have a funny one. Speaking of bleeping things out, oh, this is going to be a lot of fun. We've come up with a new concept here. It's called unnecessary. Wait a minute. What's it called? I've forgotten already.
Unnecessary pastiche censorship.
Unnecessary pastiche censorship. It's a new series. And the way it works is we simply pull a book off of our shelves, open to a random page, and read a sentence, and then insert some of those hysterical censor bleeps, you know, where you swear there must be something untoward going on underneath that. This was obviously inspired from Jimmy Kimmel and his unnecessary censorship video feature on his late night program. But why don't we roll the tape and see what we've got here? This week in unnecessary pastiche censorship. And here are your hosts, Bert Wolder and Scott Monty. What's that?
Oh, I'm sorry. I just opened up this book at random, this thing, page 200. There's something, the story apparently is called Mrs. Vanbury Takes a Trip, and there's this dialogue here. If I may interrupt, I assume you did have some purpose for arranging this meeting. Oh, yes, Mr. Holmes, as I told you, my specialty is wine, as I surmised. My husband Reginald is abroad gathering samples. I miss him desperately. Please go on. Well, 2 weeks ago, he sent me his... He did what? Sent me his... My God, wasn't it painful? Oh, no, I've always taken enormous pleasure in his... I'm sure you have, but hasn't your husband always been at the other end of it, so to speak?
That's actual dialogue?
Well, I certainly enjoy it more when he's with me. I would have sworn you couldn't enjoy it at all when he's not there. And here's the end. Oh, you're quite mistaken. I've enjoyed Reginald's while in the company of any number of friends while he's been out of the country. Zounds, mutters Watson. I must wire Vienna immediately.
Oh, my God. I have it here on my shelf.
Oh, page 200.
And there it shall remain.
Oh, you know, the sad part is I don't remember what I was reading. A lot of our conversation doesn't wind up actually in the show, and we trim things out.
Thing.
And this was from a while ago where we were talking about some topic, and there was a collection of pastiches with the same title. So we got it down from the shelf, but it wasn't. And we were reading an actual pastiche.
Yeah, I know which one. Do you want to unveil it, or do we want to keep
it? Oh, no. Let people keep it
blocked, to redacted, to protect the innocent.
Yes, I think so.
Or the guilty, as it may be.
There are enough clues there that people could probably
sure. So, well, that's a lot of fun. And hey, folks, if you have a suggestion for something
please.
We should read in unnecessary pastiche censorship,
UPC.
UPC. On iHose. If you have a suggestion as to what we should read, let us know. What a great way to use that commenting system, and what a great way to help fill the funnel, fill the pipeline here as we prepare to do one of these on each show.
How is Phil Funnel anyway? I haven't heard from
Phil
him in
Funnel.
A long while.
He's doing okay. He's feeling a little deflated, a little run down.
Phil Funnel, he takes the cake.
Washed out.
Yeah. I always see him at the state fairs.
Indeed. Well, you know who isn't feeling run down?
Who? What?
Well, our friends at Wessex Press.
Spring is the time for sympathetic magic to make sure our royal forester brings us a prosperous hunting season.
That's why we in the ancient Anglo-Saxon kingdom of Wessex have sent a skirmishing party deep into Mercia to recapture the Abbot's Bromley horn dance stolen from us in the 11th century. This is the perfect time to right old wrongs. That's why you need your copy of Sherlockian Heresies by Leo Savage from WessexPress.com. This drama critic, journalist, author, and irregular turns a critical eye toward flaws and inconsistencies in Holmes's cases. Now you can join the hullabaloo for a mere $19.95. These are April mornings, fresh and clear, when the hopes and wishes of all living things are circling like a multitude of sounds. The perfect time to reach for the pleasure only a volume from the Wessex Press can provide. Choose yours today.
Perfect.
Ah, yeah, boy, the spring tourist season in Wessex is clearly going to be exciting.
I hope they have all of the establishments stocked up there.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that the influx of tourism and of, you know, feet running through there and traffic and all the rest, boy, the natives get restless when you're not ready for them. Anywho, well, we are not here to discuss the natives' restlessness or anything like it. We are here to discuss the future.
The future, future, future.
The future, my boy. Well, the past of the Sherlockian world is ripe with lots of scholarship. And you've probably been listening to Trifles. You have been listening to Trifles, haven't you? Our other show, our companion show, where we talk about some of the inconsistencies and minutiae in the canon that are worth talking about. So we have to wonder, is Sherlockian scholarship still relevant today? And is the thinking that goes into it, is what we're seeing in current publications up to snuff with regard or with respect to what we've seen in the past? We thought we would highlight some great examples of scholarship from the past and see what they might actually give us a hint towards, what they portend for the future.
You know, a lot is made of Ronald Knox, Monsignor Ronald Knox, who published around 1912, there's been some debate about this in Sherlockian circles about whether or not this really was the start of Sherlockian scholarship, but quickly passing over that, he presented a paper at Oxford in March of 1911 that was reprinted in a collection of his satirical essays in 1928 called Studies in the Literature of Sherlock Holmes. And, you know, this tees up really this entire question really in two ways. You know, first of all, was it what Knox was doing in that essay truly groundbreaking? And I suppose we should describe the essay for a few moments for those of you who haven't read it. But second, really the larger question about this topic of the future of Sherlockian scholarship is, how often can you go to the well? I mean, Holmes has been with us since the latter part of the 19th century. There are a total of 56 short stories and 4 novels. Are there still things to write about, explore, and dwell upon? And is it going to go on forever?
Well, let's take that second question first, if we can, because look, if it's been going on since 1911, 1912, or perhaps earlier than that. Let's just take that as argument's sake, that 1912 is where it really started in earnest. That's 105 years of accumulated scholarship. Now, it has waxed and waned in between there, and those first 20, 25 years of scholarship were mostly by correspondence or by private pamphlets that were produced, or by small-run, very niche books that were written. Thinking of H.W. Bell, Dorothy Sayers, and a handful of others.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just an aside, one might still argue that such publications, such books today, would also be small run and niche. I think that's the nature of this hobby. This is not a, while Sherlock Holmes himself is broadly recognized and widely read, I think the scholarship portion is and always will be a niche interest. So that being said, 105 years of past scholarship, what does that say about the potential for the future? As you mentioned, there were 56 short stories and 4 novels that Conan Doyle helped bring to the world. Notice I didn't say wrote, because we do need to acknowledge that.
Well done.
But remember two things. One, in acknowledging the flurry of activity that was happening in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, Christopher Morley wryly observed, "Never before has so much been written by so many for so few." Right? So, one, he's acknowledging the limited distribution of such publications and such scholarship. Two, he's acknowledging the fervor, the interest that people have. And I think that's, as a first point, that's important to note. When people who are truly interested in the Sherlock Holmes stories first come to them and begin to discover that there are other people like them who notice inconsistencies, who figure out that, wait a minute, this chronology doesn't work the way it was published, or wonder about, well, what about Watson's war wound, or, you know, different things that come up. Again, things we discuss in trifles. There will always be that natural human curiosity that drives people that are interested enough in these stories to want to go and look for more. The second point, and then I will cede the floor. The second point, I think, is that Morley also rightly observed that Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson, their tales are a textbook of friendship. And more than that, the canon is really a microcosm of life. In those, I don't even know what the page total in Doubleday is, 1,200 pages, in those pages of text, you can find so much that applies to just about any aspect of life that you want. And there is always, again, this human nature, this notion of wanting to connect what you experience in literature with what you experience in life.
Well, that's true. I think, you know, you say that very well. And I think the comparison is very apt. And in fact, it's frequently referred to that by Knox, or at least in people thinking about Knox's work, that one of the driving forces behind his essay was a then current approach to biblical criticism, which was, you know, if I wanted to condense it to a sentence, a probably inaccurate and you know, not completely successful sentence, it might be looking at the Bible and the received text from the standpoint of a contemporary person and attempting to resolve, explore, twist through inconsistencies that appeared to be in conflict with current life, which, you know, I guess is what I imagine, although I don't know, was a particular aspect of biblical scholarship at the time that Knox was writing. He was, after all, writing in Oxford. Mm-hmm. And then applying that to the Sherlock Holmes stories. But, you know, it's that part of it has actually never been completely clear to me because, you know, Talmudic scholars for years, as an example, have and in fact, well, look at the Talmud, you know, the whole parallel text to plumb the inconsistencies, to look for deeper meaning, to resolve conflicts between a story told in one place one way and in another place told another way that don't completely align, gave rise to centuries of thought and discussion and argument, you know, when it came to the Talmud. Comes to the Talmud.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's really true. I mean, I know that as received wisdom, but I don't know that that's really true. I mean, was that a because if in fact it is, I mean, the reason why I suppose I'm dwelling on all of this is if it is really true, that does seem to me to be, as you were pointing out in the parallels to life, eternal. You know, it's an eternal characteristic, I think, of human inquiry to keep that going forever.
Yeah.
Because it never has an end.
Right, right. Now, there will always be instances where things of relevance come up. There will always be, again, that human curiosity, that human, you know, willingness to poke holes at things, you know, to try and tell people when they were wrong. You know, I think that's look, it fuels the internet.
But, you know, the interesting thing that just occurred to me was, you know, Conan Doyle is presented, and we got into this in some degree in our conversation with Michael Sims, as someone whose experience in a Jesuitical school had a profound effect on his outlook on life, his view of faith, his approach to religion. He felt the teachings that he was being exposed to in the Jesuitical school, to make a long story short, were in conflict with his own personal sense of the universe and a higher spiritual power, if that's how you want to refer to God.
Yeah.
And so one would have thought that if, you know, Knox is really essentially spoofing that approach to the Bible by applying it to Sherlock Holmes, that of all people, Conan Doyle would have gotten the joke.
That is true.
And he clearly didn't. I mean, he thought at least what we know about his reaction to some of this stuff was he was just astonished. I mean, he didn't see the relevance, the satirical relationship to biblical criticism, which if all of this is true, you would have thought he would.
Could be. Although, you know, his criticism of religion and of the Bible was much more literal than the scholarly type.
Well, that's true. Yeah, and he was a great writer, but he was not a an academic, a literary academic by any means.
Right.
He was a great storyteller. No, that's a good point.
And let's face it, looking at the reaction of his sons, Dennis and Adrian, or Dennis and Adrenaline, as Edgar used to call them, of how the Baker Street Irregulars conducted their business as an entity, as a literary society that has Sherlock Holmes at its center and simply acknowledged Conan Doyle as the literary agent, not the true author, they were enraged. They had no sense of humor about the thing.
Well, they immediately recognized the one fundamental characteristic of Sherlockian societies, the fascination with the character, the scholarship around Holmes, the enjoyment of this period, the promotion of Holmes and Watson, the dwelling on their cases. They perceived that the one fundamental underlying unmistakable characteristic of all this, which was that they weren't being paid.
Being paid by Sherlockians? Oh, wait. Surely you jest.
Don't call me Shirley. I say, Adrian, all of this stuff, where's our bit?
Hey, speaking of which, do you support I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere on Patreon? What a great opportunity. What a great opportunity to get over to ihearofsherlock.com, hit that now. Patreon button, and support us. We've gotten some wonderful support recently from new donors, new patrons, and we thank you for that. It helps us with the transcription. It helps us with the hosting file. It helps us with our email costs. All of that goes into running I Hear of Sherlock.
Now, I have to interrupt you here.
Go ahead.
I do have to interrupt you because
it's
occurred to me from a marketing standpoint. You know, we've had so much help in the past from our pal, Mr. Raby, approach to Patreon. And so I've got a little different technique I'd like to try if you're up for it.
Yes, please. Let's do this.
John was wounded in Afghanistan and came home so confused he couldn't tell the difference between his shoulder and his leg. Unable to get by on his meager pension, he was forced to find a roommate who smoked constantly, shot bullet holes into the wall, and couldn't hold a job. His alcoholic brother left him nothing but a scratched watch. His wife died under mysterious circumstances, and he may have married again but couldn't remember. His journals of amazing adventures were pirated by an unsuccessful ophthalmologist. We need your help to make sure John's story is never forgotten. Donate today at patreon.com/IHearOfSherlock.
I'll take it. You hear that, John Raby? I think you've got competition. Well, maybe they'll be hiring you at KPCC next. That's fantastic.
Oh, good. Well, let's see if it works.
Yeah. Well, anyway, we were talking about Edgar and the early scholarship and using Knox as our jump-off point. But what else was there in those early times that would have stood out?
Oh, well, clearly, there's so much because there was, you know, Knox was indicative of a community of people who were born in the latter part of the 19th century who were scholarly, in some cases like Chris Morley, a Rhodes scholar, people of letters, people who were brought up in a higher education environment where your grounding included naturally the classics, Latin and Greek, and you learned Latin and Greek. And so that community was very resonant to this sort of activity. And so you've got things like Christopher Morley's great paper, which I suppose, you know, is just a wonderful amplification of all of this. In 1936, Morley wrote a paper, "Was Sherlock Holmes an American?"
Oh, I'm on the edge of my seat. Was he?
Well, some people thought he was an American, including the president of the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Well,
as we discussed in bygone episode about FDR's letters to the Baker Street Irregulars.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, Morley points out was Holmes. He mentions a couple of suggestive incidents in the canon that lead to an interesting supposition that perhaps Holmes was an American. And he goes on and he says, was Holmes of American birth? It would explain much. It would explain the jealousy of Scotland Yard, the refusal of a knighthood, Holmes's expert use of the Western argot, the offhand behavior to aristocratic clients, his easy camaraderie with working people of all sorts. Always traveling first class in trains. How significant, Morley says, is Holmes's hum when he notes that Irene Adler was born in New Jersey, and how careful Watson is to insert USA after every American address, which always irritates us. Could have been something to tease Holmes. True, as Inspector MacDonald once said in the Valley of Fear, you don't need to import an American from outside in order to account for American doings. But, says Morley, let us light the cherry wood pipe and examine the data more systematically.
Hmm. There you go. Well, that's one that could be debated until the cows come home.
Hmm.
And that depends on whether your train has a cow catcher, which would be a very American thing.
Well, it is. But, you know, the lovely thing about this and why it's so relevant to this discussion of is there a future for Sherlockian scholarship and is the work being – you know, how does the work being done today compare to the work being done to the past?
Mm.
Morley just lays out – you know, we had such a community of gifted writers in those days, which is not to take anything away from the folks who are writing today. He lays out, he starts with Holmes's knowledge. His knowledge of Montpellier is an important center of scientific study, his French ancestry. He points out that while Holmes declined a knighthood in Britain, he was willing to accept the Legion of Honor in France. He talks a little bit about the circle of the Vernets, which Bonnie McBird talked about so interestingly at Chautauqua, describing the Vernets' studio in Paris as a rendezvous of liberals. Morley puts Holmes in America at the opening of Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore in 1876. He touches on the Watson's Beecher portrait. And then he starts pulling things out of the canon in the Bruce Partington plans. Mycroft, he says, cries to Holmes, "You've never had so great a chance of serving your country." "But," says Morley, "is Holmes moved by this appeal?" Holmes just shrugs his shoulders. As he says, Morley, he plainly resented Mycroft's assumption that England was his only country.
Oh, come on.
And then he goes on and he says, Holmes had a very special affection and interest regarding the United States. That's beyond question. The very first case recorded by Watson was the murder of an ex-Mormon from Cleveland, Irene Adler. The woman was a native of New Jersey. In the Redheaded League, John Clay represents the League as having been founded by an eccentric millionaire of Lebanon, PA, USA. In the Five Orange Pips, Elias Openshaw emigrated to Florida, and he goes on and on and on and on and on, pointing out but resonant to Bob Katz's and others' observations that in the canon, a lot of evil and mysterious factors seem to come into England from outside, particularly America.
Hmm. Well, you know, you have to wonder with something like that, too. Is that an instance of someone using circumstantial evidence to build their case?
Yes.
We all know what Holmes said about circumstantial evidence, that, you know, turned one way, it may mean one thing. Turned a completely different way, it may mean something completely opposite.
So. Well, yeah, and I think there's some tongue-in-cheek aspect to this. I mean, sure. Morley's essay, he goes on and he says, you know, he quotes Holmes saying, "It's always a joy to meet an American, for I'm one of those who believe that the folly of a monarch, et cetera, et cetera." But then Morley goes on to say, "Well, don't forget, Holmes disguised himself. When Holmes disguised himself as Mr. Altamont of Chicago in his last bow to deceive von Bork, he greatly resembled the familiar cartoons of Uncle Sam."
Oh, my gosh. Well, who did he resemble when he impersonated the Italian priest in The Final Problem?
Hey, that's a good question.
Samara, for you.
I think it was Chico Marx.
Oh, my gosh.
But the nice thing about Morley's essay, you know, he ends with, considering the evidence without prejudice, the idea that Holmes was at any rate partly American is enticing. As Jefferson Hope said, then he quotes Jefferson Hope, "I guessed what puzzled the New Yorkers would puzzle the Londoners. So I leave it as a puzzle, not as a proven case, for more accomplished students to re-examine. But the master's own dictum is apposite. When once your point of view is changed, the very thing which was so damning becomes a clue to the truth."
There you have it. Well, something to consider. But again, this is something that will continue to be debated throughout the ages. Will continue to vex people. You know, it's, again, human nature at work here. But beyond this golden age of Sherlockian scholarship up through the 1940s, what do we have after that?
Well, you know, it's kind of like comic books. I mean, the golden age of comics clearly was the golden age of Sherlockian scholarship clearly was Knox and the 1920s and the early 1930s. In the 1950s, you had things like Nathan Bengus, who astonishingly to me anyway, after all of this time, wrote a terrific – well, it's not that he – not astonishingly, he wrote a terrific essay – but managed to do so much with the question of Holmes's birthday. He had in the 1950s an essay entitled, "What Was the Month?" Which
January.
Oh, excellent. Well, that sounds so simple. Now what do you want to talk about? there was a book published by two volumes published by the BSI Press some years ago called The Grand Game, edited by Laurie King and Les Klinger, which has much of this all of this early scholarship and much, much more in it. One of the strange things, however, about that book is that the introduction, Bengus's essay was from the Baker Street Journal, volume 7, number 1, October 1957. There's a little paragraph of introduction in these various essays. And in this one, either Les or Laurie wrote the intro, said, a fabled collector, Bengus, became a member of the BSI in 1950. For many years, he taught Romance languages in New York. He owned 180 variants of the Sign of Four. He published what he claimed was the last will and testament of Sherlock Holmes. And then it says, the following essay, one of his many contributions to the Baker Street Journal, examines the puzzle of the Musgrave's ritual. Well, the essay doesn't say anything about the puzzle of the Musgrave's ritual. It's all about Holmes's birthday. So perhaps that's a subject for future scholarship.
There you go.
It's just a wonderful introduction, and particularly for somebody clearly who was gifted in Romance languages, you could tell the following in Morley's footsteps. And he starts with Russell McLaughlin's view that Holmes was born in January. There seems to be a general agreement Holmes was born in 1854. And off he goes. He says, I don't know the source of Mr. McLaughlin's notion that the selection of January 6th as the precise natal day is based on astrological calculation. I do not believe in the teachings of astrology any more than he does. And I hope to substantiate the January date by evidence of a more logical sort. And off he goes. Despite the fact that he's just poo-pooed astrology, he goes on to tell us that Holmes comes under the sign of Capricorn. But if in May or June, he must be assigned to Taurus, Gemini, or Cancer. Now, to denominate the master a goat is simply ludicrous.
Well, you know, Bengus was publishing all this at a time in the 50s when the Baker Street Journal itself had really stepped up to the publishing empire. Of course, Ben Abramson took it upon himself to be the publisher of the Baker Street Journal in the 1940s and produced these very lavish, thick issues of the journal. And anyone who's seen them, fails to be impressed by them. And they are just really wonderful works. And it was because they were so lavish, it's because they were so well produced, because they were so impressive, that they bankrupted Ben. and the Baker Street Irregulars decided to move out of the publishing business for a while. But it was in the 50s with these red-covered publications, some of which were reprints of previous books. There was Vincent Sterrett's The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes.
Studies in 221B.
Studies in 221B, yeah. H.W. Bell's material. A lot of stuff was produced in this silver age of Sherlockian scholarship. And it's still fairly easy to find on abebooks.com or eBay or other places like that.
Well, you know, I'm really struck when I look over some of these things, and it's why the Bengus, and you're absolutely right about the time and the characterization. But I'm struck when I just look over some of the writing, you know. Bengus closes his argument here by saying, is it just a coincidence or not rather beautifully symbolic that the master's birthday falls on Epiphany or Twelfth Night, the day celebrated in Spain as the day of the Magi kings when Spanish children customarily receive their presents? Is there any better present a Spanish father or any father could give his child on January 6th than a first volume of the adventures of the most famous man ever born on that day? Is not the whole monumental saga one of the most cherished gifts ever bestowed on an eternally grateful world? Yes, truly, January 6th is a day to conjure with It is the natal day of such other renowned people as Carl Sandburg and Joan of Arc, the great heroine of that fair country whence came the master's own grandmother. And then he closes with Janus, the Roman gods of gates and doors, and says, well, isn't 221B Baker Street the most famous door in the world? And he closes with this whole theme of Janus, for in a deeply spiritual sense, Holmes had indeed a twofold aspect. He looks to the past and to the future. The past, when we in the world were young and life was simple, and the ultimate in danger was a spider in the center of a web of 1,000 radiations. The future, with its promise of greater danger, but withal, if we are worthy of a better and freer world, whose air will be sweeter and purer for all mankind. Seen in this sense, Janus is a symbol of life everlasting, and what's more fitting than the month consecrated to him should also be the natal month of one who, in the realm of the spirit, is already invested with the mantle of immortality, and whom we shall ever honor and cherish as the best and wisest man whom we have ever known.
There it is. Yeah. So that is some good stuff. That is some good stuff. Now, obviously, we're stopping along the way. We're pausing. We're reflecting on some of these publications. We can't possibly cover all of them. Even John Bennett Shaw, the noted Sherlockian collector, the giant of a Sherlockian, figuratively and physically, couldn't list everything that was essential. So what he did is he came up with a guide called the Shaw 100, the basic Holmesian library, things that he thought people interested in Sherlock Holmes, not necessarily collectors, but people who were fervently interested in Sherlock Holmes should have in their library. And he began this list in 1977 and then updated it a few times. I believe the last update before he passed away was done in 1993, showing how fluid this passion is, how fluid this area of literature is. Now, some of the basics will always be there, but there are others that move on and off that list. And I think now that 2017 is with us, it's worth noting that, you know, there are publications that have come and gone from Shaw's time that are no longer with us. Case in point, you know, we've had the Baker Street Journal with us since 1946, almost consistently. There was just about a year there where, as I mentioned, Ben Abramson went out of business. But then it came back. Since that time, there have been other publications. Certainly the Sherlock Holmes Journal is another long-standing one, put out by the Sherlock Holmes Society of London. Usually you get two issues a year with that. You get a membership with the Sherlock Holmes Society as well as their fine publication that continues in its original format. You had, the Baker Street Miscellanea, which began in 1975 and ran all the way through 1994. That was published, I think, was it four times a year also? Mm. It was two or four times a year, which also took up the mantle of that serious scholarship that the Baker Street Journal did. And a former editor of the BSJ was an editor there, Don Pollock. And so Don had a good eye for what would make good reading, good scholarship to put together in this publication. Since that time, in the late 1990s through the early 2000s, you had the Holmes and Watson Report, which was more of a humorous scholarly publication put out bimonthly by Brad Kefauver. Of course, we had Brad on the show, I think way back in the episode 54, maybe 57, mm-hmm. somewhere around there. So we have plenty of opportunities there as we move through the decades. And now, as we move into the present era, you know, we always mention our sponsor, Wessex Press, and not just because they're a sponsor, but because they're actually a great repository of a lot of stuff. They've got the Sherlock Holmes Reference Library, in which Les Klinger pulls together a number of references to scholarship. You've got One Fixed Point in a Changing Age, which we've mentioned, a new generation on Sherlock Holmes. That was largely edited and written by a number of the Baker Street Babes. So, you know, we're seeing this interest, this movement of moving forward. And even though in this day and age we don't study Greek and Latin, you know, we're more likely to study Kardashian, I think there is still critical thought there. There is still, obviously, we do this connection with popular culture here on I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, but there's still, again, this very human interest of digging in, of looking a little deeper, of applying some ratiocination to what it is that we see and what it is that we surmise. I don't think we're ever going to cover the entirety of all the past scholarship. We're certainly not going to cover the entirety of the future scholarship. But if I were to ask you, Bert, I want you to complete this sentence.
Yes, yes.
The future of Sherlockian scholarship is
bright, bright. Well, you have to, you know, when you start sentences with the future of XYZ is, you know, you have to
bleak.
You sort of wind up with, you know, bleak, cloudy, uncertain. But we optimistic souls like to say bright, bright, or long, I think, or without end. The future of Sherlockian scholarship is without end.
Is meant for a fabled few.
<It's meant laughs>
I don't think that's going to change anytime soon.
It's meant for a fabled few. Well, you never can tell, you know, if there was a – what we need to do is create sort of a Snapchat, Instagram-like website that would take photographs, do some very clever algorithmic analysis of the objects in the photograph and connect them to Sherlockian canon. And now that would be open up whole new areas. So, you know, we might well attract many larger communities of people.
There you go. Isn't that kind of what we do at IHearOfSherlock.com?
Oh, that is. That's because we are at the nexus of Sherlock Holmes and popular culture. If it's anything, friends, if it's anything to do with Sherlock Holmes, you'll find it and much, much more at IHearOfSherlock.com.
We've been talking about the future of Sherlockian scholarship, but the past is just as ripe with material you may never have read before. And rather than hunting around aimlessly or trying to cobble together individual items from Shaw's List of 100, we have the solution, The Grand Game, published by the Baker Street Irregulars. The Grand Game is based on the lovely fantasy played by scholars and Sherlockians that Sherlock Holmes was a real person, and that the 60 canonical tales were actually written by Dr. Watson and reflect true historical events. Numerous vexing questions have stimulated the speculations of distinguished scholars for more than a century, and many of the best of these appear in this volume, covering the years 1960 through 2010. There are a great many recognizable names here in Volume 2, including William S. Baring Gould, Tupper Bigelow, Bernard Davies, Lord Donegal, Trevor Hall, Michael Harrison, and newer, more important articles by Peter Blau, David Hammer, William Hyder, Wayne Swift, Jack Tracy, and Nick Utekin are also collected in this volume. Over 400 pages consisting of scores of articles. Give yourself the grand gift of the grand game at BakerStreetJournal.com today. Boy, oh boy. I'm winded after that. And I'll just leave it at that. Yes. Well, it is time for the gas lamp. It is time to be gassy. And in this case, as we're talking about scholarship, we turned to the big, big book of Sherlockian scholarship, otherwise known as The Grand Game, a celebration of Sherlockian scholarship, Volume 1. Don't make me pull out Volume 2. And in this case, we thought, because The Grand Game is an assemblage of some of the great Sherlockian scholarship that's gone before, and you heard about it in our BSJ ad, we wanted to pull out Ronald Knox's material, straight away and read part of that to you. So here, without further ado, is Studies in the Literature of Sherlock Holmes. If there's anything pleasant in life, it's doing what we aren't meant to do. If there's anything pleasant in criticism, it's finding out what we aren't meant to find out. It's the method by which we treat as significant what the author did not mean to be significant, by which we single out as essential what the author regarded as incidental. Thus, if one brings out a book on turnips, the modern scholar tries to discover from it whether the author was on good terms with his wife. If a poet writes on buttercups, every word he says may be used as evidence against him in the inquest of his views on a future existence. On this fascinating principle, we delight to extort economic evidence from Aristophanes, just because Aristophanes knew nothing of economics. We try to extract cryptograms from Shakespeare, because we're inwardly certain that Shakespeare never put them there. We sift and winnow the Gospel of St. Luke in order to produce a synoptic problem, because St. Luke, poor man, never knew the synoptic problem to exist. There is, however, a special fascination in applying this method to Sherlock Holmes, because it is, in a sense, Holmes's own method. "It's long been an axiom of mine," he says, "that the little things are infinitely the most important." It might be the motto of his life's work. And it is it not, as we clergymen say, by the little things, the apparently unimportant things, that we judge of a man's character. If anyone objects that study of Holmes' literature is unworthy of scholarly attention, I might content myself with replying that to the scholarly mind, anything is worthy of study, if that study be thorough and systematic. But I'll go further and say that if, at the present time, we need a far closer familiarity with Sherlock Holmes's methods, the evil that he did lived after him, the good is interred with him in the Reichenbach. It is a known fact, that is, that several people contracted the dirty and deleterious habit of taking cocaine as a result of reading the books. It is equally obvious that Scotland Yard has benefited not a whit, either by his satire or by his example. When Holmes, in The Mystery of the Red-Headed League, discovered that certain criminals were burrowing their way into the cellars of a bank, he sat with a dark lantern in the cellar, nabbed them quietly as they came through. But when the Houndsditch gang were found to be meditating an exactly similar design, what did police authorities do? They sent a small detachment of constables who battered on the door of the scene of the operations at the bank, shouting, "We think there's a burglary going on in here." They, of course, were shot down, and the Home Office had to call out the whole regiment with guns and a fire brigade in order to hunt down survivors. Any studies in Sherlock Holmes must be, first and foremost, studies in Dr. Watson. Let us treat at once of the literary and biblical and bibliographical aspects of the question. First, as to the authenticity, there are several grave inconsistencies in the Holmes cycle. For example, in A Study in Scarlet and the Reminiscences from the Hand of John H. Watson, M.D., but in the story of The Man with the Twisted Lip, we hear Mrs. Watson address her husband as James. The present writer, together with three brothers, wrote to ask Sir Arthur Conan Doyle for an explanation, appending their names in the proper style with crosses after them, and an indication that this was the sign of the four. The answer was that it was an error, in fact, of editing. "Nihil aluid hic latet," says the great Sawoch. "Nisi redactor ignoratissimus." You folks at home can look that up afterwards. Yet this error gave the general impetus to Bakhneki, the history of Deutero Watson, to whom he assigns the study in Scarlet, the Gloria Scott, and the return of Holmes. He leaves the proto-Watson the rest of the memoirs, The Adventures and the Sign of Four, as well as The Hound of the Baskervilles. He disputed the study in Scarlet on other grounds. The statement in it, for example, that Holmes's knowledge of literature and philosophy was nil, whereas it is clear, and the true Holmes was a man of wide reading and deep thought. We shall deal with this in its proper place. To write fully on this subject would need 2 terms lecture at least. Sometime, when leisure and enterprise allow, I hope to deliver them. Meanwhile, I've thrown out these hints, drawn these outlines of a possible mode of treatment. You know my methods, Watson. Apply them. There you have it.
Well, first of all, who are you calling ignorantissimus?
Who are you calling Deutero?
Yeah. But, you know, isn't that so indicative of the earlier conversation? Here you have – now, admittedly, it's the early part of the 20th century. He's at Oxford. He's had all this classical education. But you have people – and the common – their common lexicon includes – the off quotation from Shakespeare, a little Latin, and he's writing for an audience in which you were expected that most well-educated people would pick up on what you were saying. I was reading some an early BSJ from the 1940s, an article that included a quotation from German, and you know I have a very rough understanding of German, so I could figure it out without going to a translator, but. That's one of the things that's really changed between then and now.
Mm.
The common parlance is a little more limited.
That's exactly right. Well, and for those of us who even came along later in the 20th century and were greeted with this text in the canon, because there are a few instances of foreign languages being used in the canon, Latin and French in particular. I don't think Conan Doyle ever used the original Greek in the Greek interpreter. There was really no way to look it up other than to find an English to Latin dictionary or to have at hand the Encyclopedia Sherlockiana or a copy of the annotated Sherlock Holmes or something of those of that sort. So, Well, for the curious among us, we can give you the translation rather than. Making you try to figure out how to spell what it is that I horribly mispronounced. We can go to the oracles at Google Translate. And nihil aluid hic latet means here lies hid nothing else.
Yeah. I thought it meant don't take this if you're lactose intolerant. It shows you how bad my Latin. Actually, I liked Latin. I liked it a lot.
Well, not enough to know what nisi redactor ignorantissimus means.
Who are you calling ignorantissimus?
Nisi, of course, means but.
That's even worse.
Ignorantissimus. Let's try with this. It must mean the most ignorant. Redactor obviously means the one who.
No, wait a minute. Didn't Redactor fight King Kong, or was that Godzilla?
Well, I'm afraid that's scholarship for another day. Sadly. Well, until that other day, I must remain yours truly, Johnny Dollar. No, Scott Monty.
And I am redacted to be Bert Wolder.
The game's afoot.
You know, I'm afraid that in the pleasure of this conversation, I am neglecting business of importance, which awaits me elsewhere.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to join us again for the next episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes.
Goodbye, and good luck, and believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes.